Okay, so let's start discussing these questions as the class. So what is structural ecosystem model? So how would you define structural ecosystem model?
You define graphs.
So you define it as graphics.
Like a regression model where each of a variable is a factor which are measured through multi indicators.
That's one application of structural regression model, yes.
The structural regression models take the big view, like the whole model at a time, rather than taking paths. Individual paths and doing the analysis.
So you estimate everything simultaneously.
Yeah.
And SCM is the acronym sometimes used for simultaneous equation modeling as well.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. So it shows relationships between all the variables you need, even between the latent variables.
What is a latent variable?
So which is not visible, so not measurable. Which you figure out through the factor analysis.
Yeah, so latent variables are variables for which we don't have data, and observed variables are variables for which we have data. Anything else?
I think on this view of relationships among variables and paths, a great thing of this kind of models is that they map the various theory types that we have in IS, that we make IS research, meaning when we get a diagram from the structural equation modeling, it's easy to identify where the theory is or discuss with it. So we have, it's nice that it you can match it easily to the theory, or this theory of relationships among concepts.
Yeah, so one of the nice things that structural equation modeling has given us is the path diagram, which shows up what are the concepts or in the theory, how they are related, and what kind of indicators each of those concepts have. So that's that. But it's not really, you could draw a path diagram even if you did a regression analysis-based study. So path diagram, that would be very confusing for most readers. But the path diagram itself is not the same as the structural equation model. So but it's the path diagrams are a nice way of presenting your measures and your theory.
From a model fitting perspective, if you're trying to fit all of the data, when there are same, like several equations, okay, I think that using like sequential regression compared to that structural equation model is more likely to find more optimal solution because it's simultaneously optimized to fit the data.
Define optimal.
Like some regression models that fit the data better than computing model. For example, if you're trying to estimate the R-square value of the different models, and then you're trying to find a model that better can predict or can make a better estimation of the models.
Okay, well, let's estimation and prediction are two completely different things. So structural ecosystem models are not typically used for prediction. And and regression model itself fits the data better than a structural ecosystem model, almost always. So,
imagine when you have like a several variable, like
yeah.
A structural equation model, where you have a latent variable. Fitting individual regression, you derive the relationship, and then when you're simultaneously fitting.
If your model is correctly specified, your structural equation model, then your estimates will be more precise than if you were estimating with separate regression analysis. If your model is not correctly specified, then the structural equation modeling results will be a lot more worse than regression analysis results typically. So it's not as straightforward. That brings us to the advantages of structural equation modeling. Why would you want to use structural equation modeling?
It allows us to explicitly error terms for measurement.
Yeah, it allows us to model certain kind of measurement errors. And why would that be useful?
Because the assumption that the measurement is flawless is not valid most of the time.
And what happens if you make an invalid assumption that measurement is flawless?
You are making systematic error then, so you, it's not, your estimator is not valid.
It's not consistent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So structural equation modeling allows, if we have data that are contaminated with some kind of measurement there, we'll talk about that in a few slides from now, then regression analysis results will be systematically encoded. If your data are contaminated with measurement error, and you know what is the error is like, so if you can safely assume that the error is random noise, then structural equation modeling corrects for that measurement error. So that's one advantage. What other advantages structural equation modeling has?
You can have indirect effects. You can model it.
Yeah, like mediation effects. But we can do that with regression analysis as well. So that's not an advantage of structural equation modeling. The other advantage is that we can do model testing. So we can test if the model fits the data. With regression model, we cannot say whether the model is correct or not. With structural equation model, we can say that the model, whether the model is correct or not. We can test the model. If the model passes the test, it may be correct. If it doesn't pass the test, then we know that the model is wrong for the data. Okay, let's talk about some of the important concepts from the previous classes and then also bring some new concepts. And one of the most important things to understand when you start learning about structural equation modeling is the idea that linear modeling implies a correlation matrix. And most introductory books on SCM start by explaining that structural equation models are estimated by fitting implied correlation matrix to empirical correlation matrix. What it means, it's going to be clear in a few slides from now, but that's not that's one way of estimate. We can also estimate structural equation models differently, but that's the easiest way to understand estimation. And once you understand estimation, then you can understand what to do when your estimation doesn't work, which is pretty common. So I haven't encountered a single empirical data set that I have collected myself or an unpublished data set that would not be problematic in some way. So the idea of linear modeling plus a correlation matrix is that if we have a linear model, so this is a regression model, and it is linear because the y here is a linear combination. It's a weighted sum of these x's plus this error term here. So this is a path diagram presentation of a normal regression model. The x variables here are exogenous, so they're allowed to be freely correlated. We have the curved arrow here representing a correlation, and then we have a regression path or a weight or however we like to call it. This like straight arrow, yeah.
Yeah, may I ask you a question? Because the thing is in linear regression, there should be the basic assumption is that there's no multicollinearity in the independent variables. So why do they have any correlation over there?
Well, that's not an assumption of regression analysis.
What?
Regression analysis assumes that each variable brings more information to the model. So the collinearity, the lack of the assumption in regression analysis, Woolrich's assumption number 3 is that any of the independent variables cannot be expressed as an exact linear combination of other independent variables. So collinearity means that one independent variable can be explained by others, and that's if collinearity is zero, then an independent variable is completely uncorrelated with every other independent variable. If collinearity is one, perfect collinearity, then it means that an independent variable is completely redundant. It doesn't bring any more information.
So are you sure that multicollinearity is not an issue in a linear
regression? It is not an assumption. So and if your variables are uncorrelated, that would be very exceptional. Typically, if you think about what your variables are, so you typically have an interesting study variable, and then you have a set of control variables. And the control variables are only relevant if they are correlated with the interesting variable and have an effect on the dependent variable. So multicollinearity is pretty misunderstood issue. I talked about that on the second class, and you can say check Woolridge's book. So there's no limitation. What multicollinearity, when these variables become increasingly more correlated, what it does is that it's more difficult to say which of the two variables or which of the three variables actually has a causal effect on this dependent variable. So let's say that we want to know whether a company's number of people or company's revenue influences more on company's profitability. Revenue and personnel are highly correlated because they're both measures of company size. So we have a collinearity issue because we need lots and lots of data to know whether it's actually the number of people or the amount of money that the company brings in that influences profitability. So, but collinearity is not an assumption of a regression analysis, except that each variable must bring new information. So we can't have correlation of 1.0 or minus 1.0.
Then may I ask another question?
Yeah, sure.
For example, when you're doing meta-analysis with, for example, these frequentist techniques, and you use ANCOBA, for example. Mm-hmm. And you, for example, one assumption is that the independent variable is equally distributed across all the different experiments that you're doing.
Yeah.
So my point is, there are many papers that say that basically if your independent variable is correlated with a variable within each of the different experiments, then your results are flawless. So my point is, if multicollinearity is not an issue, what are those papers suggest?
You would have to point me to a paper and then I can tell you. Because I haven't seen that argument, at least the way I understood it. I haven't seen it presented. So you can ask it in the course form, and I'll try to answer the question.
Yeah.
Meta-analysis is something that we don't cover on the course, but you are touching many issues that are related to, for example, range restrictions, which relates to or corrections for range restriction, which relates to the distribution of the variable.
Yes, because it's really weird that, for example, I put you a case that we run a linear regression in one of our experiments or two experiments together, and we had two variables. They were like highly, highly correlated, and the thing is that there was one that was saying, hey, this is significant, and another one that it was, hey, this is not significant. But the point is that they are so highly correlated that if you put them separately, both are significant.
Yeah.
So, what's the point, I mean?
Mm. Yeah, so let's say that we have an important, we want to know whether a company's number of people influences company's profitability. And we have an important alternative hypothesis that it's actually the money that the company takes in, the revenue that influences profitability. So they are correlated at 0.9 or something. And neither of those are significant in small samples. So what's our solution? We leave out the control variable. No, that's not a good solution. So you could just check the second course lecture. So there's I discussed the issue there. And you can ask the meta-analysis question on the course.
Yeah, well,
let's move on. So the idea of linear model is that if this model is true, then the correlations between x's, they are free, so we don't care about those. But the correlations between x and y can be defined based on these model parameters here. So the idea of tracing path rules is that we take, for example, the correlation of the x1 and y, we start from x, and then we see how many different ways we can get from x1 to y. So we can go directly, or we can travel one correlation. We can take only one correlation at the, and no more, and then we go down. So we can go down, or we can take a correlation and then go down, and take a correlation and then go down. So the correlation between x1 and y is the sum of this regression path, that regression path, and that correlation and that regression path times that correlation. So that brings gives us all the correlations between x's and y's can be calculated the same way, and the variance of y is simply they are a weighted sum of these variances and these correlations and this error term variance here. So that was the idea. I talked about this on the second and third course, and let's now see how this idea is applied to structural ecosystem models. So we'll start with path analysis. What is path analysis?
Where all the variables are observable.
Yeah, it's a structural ecosystem modeling technique where we don't have any latent variables. So we have values for each variable. There are the typical application for path analysis is a mediation model. So the idea is that we have one exogenous variable, then we have a final dependent variable, and the effect of the exogenous variable to the final dependent variable goes through a mediating variable. So we are, instead of saying that x causes y, we are saying that x causes y through the mechanism m. And why would this kind of models be interesting to study?
I think they are more explanatory, meaning they don't tell you just x gives y, but they explain the mechanisms behind why is that.
Yeah, they allow us to refine theory. So we say that our personal commitment is related to IS success. And then, well, why would that be the case? Then we have a couple of alternative mechanisms, and we can test those mechanisms using a mediation model. Then we talked about this,
but x doesn't influence y.
Not in this particular example. It could be, there could be a direct effect as well.
Okay.
We had on the second class, we talked about this kind of models, and we went through two different estimation strategies. We focused on the Barron and Kenny method. So the idea of estimating the mediation model is that we can just regress first y on x to see if there is something to be mediated. Then we can regress mediator on x to see if there's a relationship. And then we regress y on mediator and x to see if there's a mediation effect. So we run these three regression analyses, and based on those, we make our conclusion of whether there's mediation or not. So that's the traditional regression-based approach. Then the path analysis approach, or structural ecosystem modeling approach, is that we actually don't specify separate regression analysis, but we specify one model that we estimate as one go. The idea of estimating this model is that we apply the tracing rules again. So we have here data correlation matrix that I just generated, and then we estimate this model based on the data correlation matrix by calculating correlation between x and m and x and y based on the model parameters. So x is exogenous here, so we'll just have its correlation with itself, its variance is 1. What is the correlation between x and m?
Beta m 1.
How many different ways we can go from x to m?
From beta m 1.
Directly?
Can we go here?
No.
Yeah, because we can't go down and then back up again. So that's beta m 1 is the correlation between x and m. What is the correlation between x and y?
Direct beta y1.
Mm-hmm. X
to
y.
And then indirect over m.
Yeah.
Beta m1 times beta y2.
Yeah. And it's the sum of these two paths. So it's that path and this path here. So we go along the path, we multiply everything together, and then we sum all the paths. That gives us the implied correlation. And the variance of the mediator is simply we go from mediator to exogenous variable, and then we come back. So we go from mediator to x, and we come back. We go from mediator to y, to u, the error term, and we come back. And the error term here doesn't have a coefficient, because that coefficient is fixed to be 1. So we get the variance of the mediator is the variance of x multiplied by beta m1 squared, because we go to x and back, and then it's the error variance. What is the correlation between y and m? You're going to be doing this thing in the computer class in the afternoon, so pay attention. What is the one correlation between y and m?
Beta y2, whatever.
Yeah, we can go directly. Any other ways of getting from m to y?
Through x.
Yeah, through x. We can go up and then down. So it's going to be beta y2 plus beta m1 times beta y2.
And why both?
Why both?
Yeah.
Because you go here and you go back and you multiply everything that you encounter on the way together. So the idea of...
And why couldn't you go from x to y both?
Huh?
No idea what I'm saying.
M and y directly, and m and x and y. So what is the... that's, you can just apply the rules mechanically. But what is the interpretation of that, this path here? The idea is that the correlation between m1 and y is their direct effect. So there's a direct, let's call it causal effect now, direct causal effect from m and y that explains some of the correlation. And there's also a common cause for those two variables. So the correlation between m and y is the direct effect plus the effect caused by this common cause x. So this x would be... a source of spurious correlation. It is correlation that is not accounted by the direct correlation between M and Y, or the direct effect. So that's an example of spurious correlation. Then the variance of Y is something like that. So we go from, we take the variance of U here, we take variance of M, and U, we take variance of there's something wrong with that equation. Anyway, you can trace it and then you can calculate what it is.
But you have to do it with the software, or the software?
The software will do this for you, but the reason why it's very important to understand is that when the software gives you nonsensical results, what do you do? Or the software will not give you results. What do you do? You press a button, your structural equation modeling follows the approach of I draw my path diagram, I press a button, I get results. What happens if you don't get results, or you get results that you don't either like, or you get results that are nonsensical? Then you really have to understand what happens when you push the button. Otherwise, or you have to have somebody to call and then do it for you. But that doesn't work out for most people. So to understand the basics, what happens when you push the button is really necessary. With regression analysis, not so much. You don't really have to understand the least squares criterion for doing regression really well, because regression analysis always gives you a result, and the result is always something that you can interpret. But for example, if regression analysis, structural equation modeling analysis tells you that an error variance is negative, R squared from a structural equation modeling is 1.5. What do you do about it? Then you have to understand how the R squared is calculated to understand why it goes above 1. So R squared is bounded between 0 and 1 in regression analysis. In structural equation modeling, it can go to infinitely high. And that is typically a symptom of a problem. What the problem is requires some understanding. Then we have the concept of degrees of freedom, which is very important in structural equation modeling. So here the degrees of freedom is calculated based on the data. So we get 5 units of information from the data. So we take the variance of x as it is, but the correlation between x and m, variance of y, and these two correlations depend on the model. So the data gives us 5 units of information. Then we have 5 things that we estimate. We have 3 regression coefficients, 2 error variances, and we have 5 free parameters that we estimate. our degrees of freedom is the difference between data and free parameters. So what the statistical concept of degrees of freedom, actually how it's defined, it's not particularly important for you. But the way you can understand it is that it tells you how much excess information you have that you could use for estimation. So now we don't have any excess information. That means that we can't add anything more to the model. So basically, we could add a correlation with these two error terms, but we can't estimate the model any more meaningfully because our degrees of freedom would go to minus one. So degrees of freedom, when it's large, it tells you that you could add more things to the model. When it goes to small, to zero, then you know that you can't add anything more to the model. If it's negative, then you know that you have a serious problem. And degrees of freedom is always reported in the default output in any structural ecosystem model. They always report you degrees of freedom on chi-squared. Some don't even report you the coefficients unless you specifically ask for them, because the chi-square and degrees of freedom are so important.
Parameters, what is like free?
Free means that that is something that is estimated from the data. So we have beta M1, beta Y2, beta Y1. So these are recurrent paths that we estimate from the data. We could also tell the software that we know that this coefficient is 0.2. Estimate everything else, but keep this at 0.2. Then we will gain one degree of freedom.
So like these three coefficients plus the error term?
Plus the error variances, yeah. So five. Some structural ecosystem modeling software will tell you where the degree of freedom come from. For example, Amos will tell you that. And we're going to talk about that in a few slides from now. And there's a nice online calculator where you can tell information about your model, how many variables you have, how many regression paths, and then that calculator gives you the degrees of freedom. I'm going to cite it in a few slides.
Just a question about the degrees of freedom. Are they to be reported in the publications, and do they need to be zero?
No. Degrees of freedom, if it's zero, then we say that the model is just identified. It is not problematic if the degrees of freedom is zero. It just means that your model cannot be tested. If degrees of freedom is positive, then you will get the chi-square significance test for model fit. And degrees of freedom and chi-square are two of the most important things in structural ecosystem modeling application. And if those are not reported, then it's not reported appropriately. So how do we estimate this? We try to make the modeling implied correlation matrix. We have the betas here. We try to make these cells here as close as possible to the data correlation matrix by adjusting the betas and the error variances.
So you estimate the betas and the mus?
We estimate the betas and the mus here.
Okay.
Or the variances of the mus.
Okay.
So variance of u here and beta.
Okay. And not m and y? not m.
No, m,
okay,
x and y are variables.
Yeah.
These errors are latent variables, and the variances of latent variables are estimated. The variances of observed variables are just whatever you observe from the data, and then the regression paths are estimated. So how do we estimate? How is normal regression model estimated? What is the estimation principle for a regression analysis model? Yeah, least squares. How do you can you explain the least squares criteria?
So you try to minimize the errors operation.
Yeah, you try.
You're minimizing the distances between the predicted points and the original data points.
Yeah. And what is the distance called?
Euclidean distance.
Schumann squares.
No, it's the residual. The difference between the observed value. And the fitted value based on the model in the regression analysis is a residual. Then you take squares of each residual, and then you take sum of those squares. So square means you raise it to the second power. The idea is that if one observation is very far from the regression line, then that observation will influence the regression line more than those observations that are very close to the regression model. So in path analysis, we apply the exact same logic. So in regression analysis, we calculate the difference between each observation and the corresponding predictive or fitted value, raise each to the power of 2, and the sum of these is ordered least squares estimator. Then we make that as small as possible, so least squares, and that gives us the regression estimates. Then in path analysis, we calculate the difference between each unique cell in the observed correlation matrix and the implied correlation matrix. That difference is called residual covariance or residual correlation. We raise each difference to power of 2. We take sum of those powers and we minimize the sum. That's called unweighted least squares estimator. And that's the most simplest way of estimating a structural regression model using the correlation matrices. In practice, we don't use unweighted least squares because it's problematic for reasons that we don't cover in the class. Instead, we weight the residuals, and that produces, when we weight the residuals in a certain way, it produces maximum likelihood estimator. And so the idea is that minimizing a discrepancy function will lead to estimates that are optimal in a well-defined way. And also the minimum of the discrepancy function can be used to assess the model goodness. So the sum of squared residuals in regression analysis is used when you calculate the R square. So R squared was defined as the sum of squared total sum of squares. So you have the variance of data minus the sum of squared residuals divided by the total variance of the data. Okay, so in software, we do it that way. So this is with R. We have output here, and this is with the Laban package, but it doesn't really matter which software you use because they all will give you the exact same results for this particular model. The reason why I'm using Laban is that it implements the unweighted least squares. Most other software don't, because it's not a useful estimator except for teaching. So the first thing that we have is estimation information. So we are, this is actually with maximum likelihood. So we got some information. Then we have parameter estimates. So let's look at the estimates first. We got these regression paths here. Y1 is 0.28, this one here. Beta M1 is 0.67. That one,
excuse me, which software is this?
This is R, Laban package.
Laban
package. That's the best structural regression modeling package in Laban, in R. And if I have to do a structural regression modeling study and I don't have any constraints on which software I would use, and it's a basic study, I would use this package, because it's so useful, and then I can use R for all my analysis. I could use M Plus as well, which is the most advanced software. It's more powerful and in a way easier to use than R, but the problem with that would be that then I would have to use something else for data preparation because it's just focused on construction.
What about Amos?
I don't really like Amos for one. I don't use it because I'm a Mac user. It doesn't have a Mac person. And another thing is that Amos can only be used with a path editor, and that will start to slow you down once you understand how these things work. Mm-hmm. So if you try to, I'll demonstrate you a screencast where I add 45 correlations and into a model. And the way to remove those model correlations is to click each correlation, press delete, click and delete. Compare that to just painting things in your text file that defines the model and clicking delete.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Amos is it's okay. It gives the same results as this model, but I just don't like using it.
And does it have this the Bayesian counterpart? I mean, because in Amos, the good thing is that you can as well use Bayesian statistics.
We don't talk about Bayesian statistics on this course, and I'm not sure. There is certainly an extension. I'm not sure if it's available in the base package of Laban, but there is an extension for Bayesian analysis.
Okay.
So, is this a full mediation model or a partially mediation model? We get the estimate is 0.028 for the direct effect. It is not statistically significant because the p-values are large, so we conclude that this is a full mediation. And I generated the data to be a full mediation, so I know that's the correct one. Okay, but this is something that we could have done with the regression analysis. So we could actually run regressions, regress y on m and x, and we would get the exact same results. So using structural equation modeling for estimating this kind of full mediation model is largely a waste of time.
Can you repeat what's a full mediation? Because
it is full mediation. Did I say that it is not full mediation? It is full mediation because the direct path beta y1 is not statistically significant. Yeah, this key value here is close to 1. It's not small, so it's statistically significant. It's not significant, so we can't say that this path is non-zero. We can't make it conclusive.
Okay. And what's the difference between full and partial mediation?
Well, partial mediation means that there's a direct effect from x to y, and we can't rule out for which we can't say that it's by chance only. So the idea of p-value was to rule out chances and exponents. We can say that this is so small, it could be by chance. It's possible that there is no effect between x and y. If the effect that you actually observe was large, then we couldn't attribute it to chance. And that's what p-value tells us. Can we attribute the result to chance only?
So do you run it, how many times you run the regression? So in the previous slides, with the rule, there are like three times.
Yeah, the Barron and Kenny procedure, which is very commonly used, involves three regressions.
So how many times you run it here?
This is estimated all together.
Right.
So we estimate it all together. There is no separate regression analysis being run.
Oh yes. Okay.
So instead of running a separate regression analysis, we'll take the data correlation matrix, we'll take the implied correlation matrix, we optimize the betas to make the implied and data matrix as close to one another as possible. Okay, so that is gives us the exact same result as regression analysis because our degrees of freedom is zero. This is just identified model. Estimating just identified models with structural regression modeling is largely a waste of time. You could have done with regression analysis, and we have the regressions before we even open our structural regression modeling software.
So it's always a problem if there is a direct effect between x and y in this kind of models.
Well, it depends on what's your theory. If you're saying that there's it's a result. It's not a problem.
Yeah.
So a small p-value or a large p-value, it is not generally not a problem. If you have a non-significant result, it is not the problem. It's your research finding. And then you just have to report that finding.
Yeah.
So if you really, really want to make a claim that there's full mediation, and then you have been building your career on the claim that there's a full mediation, and then you discover that it's a partial mediation, then it could be a problem for your career that your research findings contradict your claim.
Or for your paper.
But for your actual paper, actual analysis, it's not a problem.
Okay.
And maybe it's your data, right? I mean,
yeah. Of course, your data could be flawed somewhere.
And you want to run more experiments.
Then we run more studies. If you have a counterintuitive finding or finding that you don't like, you publish it and you run more studies. And then when we have replicated the finding in 5 or 10 studies, then we can be sure that we know what the effect is.
So
but from any individual study, just one study, the evidence that these techniques provide us, unless it's an experimental study, it's quite weak. But experiments are not flawless either. Like if you think how medicines are tested, it has to be quite often that there are two independent laboratories that confirm the result before we can actually put the medicine on sale. So even there, where we have very strong designs, we have to do our replications to understand what the effects are. Okay, let's do another model. And this is a model where applying structural ecosystem modeling actually would make sense. So the model here differs that we don't include the direct path here. So we are saying that we have a strong theory that there is no partial mediation. This is a full mediation, and we tell software to estimate the full mediation model and leave the partial mediation out altogether.
So we have another model, or this is just real?
This is we could call this another model, another analysis, or a variant of the previous model. But now we're estimating a model that has two regression paths. We have beta M1, beta Y2, and two error variances. The model implied correlation X is 1 again. X and M is again beta M1. And what is the correlation between X and Y?
Beta M1, beta Y2.
Yeah, so now we are saying that the correlation between X and Y occurs only because X causes M and M causes Y. That's the only reason why there's a correlation. There is no other possible reason for there to be a correlation.
Excuse me, and those betas are between 0 and 1?
No.
Or minus 1 and 1, or they can be...
Regression coefficient can be between minus infinity to plus infinity. There's no bounds.
Okay, so that's our regression coefficient, and it can be then the correlation greater than...
Yeah. Well, these are regression coefficients don't have a range restriction. Well, if you say that... If these data are standardized, or we say that these are standardized regression coefficients,
okay,
then they are bounded between minus 1 and 1, because standardized regression coefficient in a regression with just one explanatory variable is equals correlation.
So that's a standardized.
Yeah, well, we are talking about standardized estimates here. In the afternoon, when I have you to do this example on a computer, or a different example, then you will have to work with unstandardized estimates. So we apply tracing rules for the other parts as well. And what are our degrees of freedom? How many units of information do we get from the data? How many of these correlations or invariances here depend on the model parameters?
Four.
How many? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Five. So five things in the data or in the implied matrix depend on the model parameters. So we have five. We basically get another way of thinking about this is that the variance of X doesn't give us any information on the parameters, because the implied correlation, implied variance of X doesn't depend on any of the model parameter values. But these ones do. So we get five units of information. How many things we have here to estimate?
Four.
Two regression paths and two error variances. So we have four free parameters. And that gives us how many degrees of freedom?
One.
What does the one degree of freedom now tell us?
That we can confirm whether this thing works or not.
We could use that for model testing, yeah, but what else?
And more relationships.
Yeah, we could add one more relationship to the model and still estimate it. So we could add the correlation between X and Y, or we could say that X is correlated with this error term here, or that these error terms are correlated. And we could still estimate the model.
Yeah, excuse me, because
yes.
This structural equation modeling seems like you can do statistical fishing really easily. I mean, you can program a loop that goes eliminating edges,
mm-hmm.
and you create many theories out of that.
Yeah, you can. You can do the same regression analysis, and you can also specify a model with the results that you like, and program your computer to find the data that will support your analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but that's unethical. So unless you tell right in your paper that I program my computer to go through all possible models with these 100 variables, and reported the models with highest R square.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you report it as you did, then it's not unethical. Of course, your paper wouldn't be accepted because it's nonsense thing. But if you do data mining, particularly with computer, trying to find your models, and you report it as if you derive one model based on theory and then you test with that model, then that's you're lying.
Yeah,
you can always misuse things.
You know, on this point, it's not a bit what these machine learning techniques try to do.
Yeah, but machine learning techniques typically don't try to uncover a structure that underlies the data.
Yes.
We don't use machine learning techniques to test theory. Rather, we use those to make predictions. And prediction and explanation are two completely different things. So if someone tells me that they are doing prediction, I always ask, why don't you use neural networks? And that's a pretty good kind of like test of whether the person is actually interested in prediction or whether they are using the term prediction for something else. Because neural networks are typically, they produce you a statistical model that really cannot be interpreted in any meaningful way. It predicts really well, so we can, but we don't really know how it works.
There are methods like SVM and logistics regression as well. Used quite well in like prediction problem.
Yeah, prediction. But prediction and explanation are completely different things. We don't talk about prediction. So prediction is very useful. For example, I use prediction when I buy or sell an apartment or a house. So I take data that I know about the house, and I take realized sales prices, and I calculate the prediction model, and then I can use the model to predict how much I would have to pay for a house or an apartment, or how much I could ask for a house or an apartment. It does work pretty well, this part.
Yeah, but for example, a regression analysis, I mean, you use linear regression for prediction.
Yeah, it can be used for both, but conceptually prediction and explanation, even though we can use sometimes the same techniques, it's not the same thing. Okay, so this is over-identified. We call it over-identified because the degrees of freedom is positive. And now the estimation information is actually gives us something interesting. So we have here degrees of freedom is 1. We have a chi-square type statistic that is non-significant. So p-value for chi-square, we have minimum function test statistic here. And so what does that mean?
Maybe our model is true.
So let's think about this for a moment. So normally when you see a p-value, do you want it to be large or small in your analysis?
Small.
Yeah, in regression analysis, you typically want the p-value to be small because you're hypothesizing that there are effects and you want to reject chance as an explanation. So would it be a problem that the p-value here is large?
No.
It's desirable because we are actually asking a different question here. So let's take a look at that, what it tells us. We have the data correlation matrix here, and we have the model implied correlation matrix calculated based on the estimates provided by the Lavoisier package. And then we have the residual correlation matrix. So the model is estimated by making these residual correlations as small as possible. And now we are interested in knowing that this is a non-zero in the sample. So we have a residual. We want to know whether that degree of misfit, so the model doesn't perfectly reproduce the data correlation matrix. So can we attribute this small amount of misfit to chance only? So that's what we want to know. And the p-value answers the question, is it reasonable to assume that this is zero or equal to less? If the p-value, the null hypothesis is that there is no difference between the population and the implied matrix, and we want to be accepting the null hypothesis here. So we want to be saying that there is no difference, because that means that our model is possibly correctly specified. And the chi-square is a statistical test for that.
What did, can you repeat it, please?
So we want to say that this is so small value that it could have happened by chance only. So it, we say that it's not evidence of misspecification because the difference is so small, and in small samples our models will never fit exactly because of sampling fluctuations. So the idea of sampling, even if this was zero in the population, it is non-zero in the sample. The idea of sampling variance is that, let's say that our, the mean height of all in for the students is 170 centimeters. Even if that was true, your average height would not be exactly 170. Because in small samples, your statistics will be a bit different than the population values, just depending on who decides to arrive and who doesn't.
But in the other example, it was one.
The p-value was zero in the other example, or it was not defined because the model fits perfectly here. So the p-value is exactly one, or it's undefined, or
it's undefined.
It's zero depending on software because your model fits perfectly. The difference, all residuals are exactly zero because it's just identified model. Then we get estimates here. And the idea of the chi-square test is that it tests whether our model specification is reasonable for the data. If the chi-square rejects the data, the model, it means that the model is misspecified. If this is statistically significant, then we have a problem. So having a regression path that is significant or not is a research finding. Typically, when you have a significant chi-square here, it's not a finding, it's an indication of a problem because you're trying to fit a model to the data that doesn't explain the data well, and any estimates that you get from the model are likely to be misleading if the model doesn't fit.
Will the best model be the one with the higher p-value?
No, you don't use p-value for model comparison. You're using some other techniques that we'll talk about tomorrow. But the best model is it's based on theory and your empirics. So you can't say that one model is better than other based on any individual number. It depends on what you're trying to do with your models. Sometimes when you have a significant chi-square, you can still publish your results. Because if you can't find a reasonable explanation for the misfit, it's still, you get some results. So I'm going to talk more about that tomorrow.
Here we focus only the correlation between X and Y because all the other residuals are zero, right?
Yeah.
But this is not typical.
It's not typical.
There might be residual covariance in other correlations as well.
Yeah, we're going to look at more complex example, but just to demonstrate the idea, is I'm just using this simple example. So there are, this is called over-identification test because we have excess information, we have 1 degree of freedom, and we are that means that the model is over-identified, and basically we are using that excess degree of freedom for model testing. One way to understand model testing is that we could estimate this model without information from the X and Y correlation. So we can estimate beta in 1, that's the correlation with X and M, and beta Y2 is the correlation with M and Y, so we don't really need this information at all. So we estimate the model with a subset of the information that we have, and then we compare the other information that we have and see whether it's consistent with the predictions from our model or the model implications. And that's the idea of over-identification testing. So this is called the chi-square test, and how it's defined, it's explained here. And the important part is we want to accept the null hypothesis.
But you can never say that null hypothesis. Right, that's the basic, so.
No, we can never say that the null hypothesis must be true because we could have a false negative as well. So we are incorrectly.
Yeah, you not, basically don't yeah. want to accept.
We want to accept the null hypothesis. We cannot confirm the null hypothesis separately. And even if we accept the null hypothesis, it doesn't guarantee that the causal effects or that these correspond to any causal effects. It just tells that our model fits the data, so it survived one test. It doesn't guarantee that the model is in any other way useful. We could specify meaningless models that fit data really well, and they would still be meaningless.
I would say that we don't want to reject the null hypothesis.
No, we don't. We could say that we don't want to reject the null hypothesis. That would be more appropriate than we want to accept the null hypothesis.
Okay.
But how big should their degree of freedom be in respect to the data, the number of data items, or maybe the
freedom? Yeah, the degrees of freedom are. Goes up exponentially when your number of indicators increases, roughly. So the degrees of freedom for this model is in 1, with very large survey data, it can be in the thousands.
Okay.
So we can see that we have here, we have 5 units of information. Mm-hmm. If we would add one more dependent variable, let's call it y2, which depends on y, then we would have one more row here. So we would have 3 correlations,
yes.
And 1 variance. So we would get 4 more units of information.
Okay.
We would consume 2 by estimating a regression path and an error variance for that y2 variable.
Yeah.
So our degrees of freedom would go up by 2.
Okay.
So in the empirical paper, the Meskin and Lazzarini, their initial confirmatory factor analysis model has 147 degrees of freedom.
Yeah. Because I felt bullied by that because they just said we have degree of freedom that is this number of times more than something that so we accept. I'm like, okay.
No, you look at the p value, and that's what you look at. The degrees of freedom are itself. It's not just tells you how many more things you could add to the model, but it doesn't really tell you any valuable information. If you have large degrees of freedom, then you have lots of power to test the model. If you have small degrees of freedom, then your power for model testing is small. But there is like no depends on so many things. So no rules of thumb for that.
Okay.
Just look at the p-value of chi-square. Same thing with the chi-square statistic itself. The chi-square, the p-value is calculated by based on this number here, the degrees of freedom.
Mm.
But the numbers themselves don't really tell you anything. Just look at the p-value.
Actually, they started the discussions concerning the degree of freedom and how large it is and stuff like that when their p-value actually, their value was significant. And so, I was just going by the rules that if the p-value for the chi-square is significant, like it's small, then of course you just reject the model. But they were trying to prove why their model would still be useful.
Yeah,
by following
models.
So
models that don't fit the data perfectly. So chi-square is the measure of perfect fit. And models that don't fit the data perfectly can still be useful. We'll talk more about that tomorrow. But when your model is rejected, the first thing that you have to do is to try to understand why the model doesn't fit the data. Because there can be something that influences your conclusions. So the idea of the chi-square of this test here is that if we have one error correlation here, these happen to be fixed to the sample values for technical reasons. So we have one residual here, and this residual, if the model is correctly specified, it's normally distributed. So if we have one residual, we compare it to normal distribution. What if we have two residuals that are non-zero? What do we do?
Type one error.
No. Let's look at this. So the idea is that we have zero here, and then we have the actual residual here. We want to see how far from zero the residual is.
So that's a Kolmogorov, you mean, not the sort of. I mean, because what I say, you want to check whether this normal the residual.
No, is something completely. So the null hypothesis is that all residuals are zero. If we have one residual that we compare, then we can compare the actual value of the residual against the normal distribution, center at zero. If it's far from zero, then we know that it's unlikely that we get that kind of observation by chance.
This is a Kolmogorov Smirnov test.
Yeah. So, but we look at how far from zero the observation is, and we use the normal distribution as a reference. What do we do if we have two residuals?
Would they vary the normal distribution?
No, we don't do that. We basically could, but we don't do that. So, if an observation is from far from x, on this axis, we just look at the value on the axis. When we have two x's, we have one residual here, another one here. How do we know how far this red point is from the origin?
First and second.
No. High school math, how do we know? What is the distance here?
The square and the square.
Yeah, so we take square of that plus square of that, and we take a sum and we take square root. So it tells us how far we are from both variables being zero. And that's the idea of chi-square testing or chi-square distribution. So the idea is that we have two normally distributed variables, then we raise those variables to the power of 2, we take a sum, but we don't actually need to take the square root because we just want to have a benchmark. So just for benchmarking purposes, whether we have this distance or the square of this distance as our metric doesn't really make a difference. So the idea of here with one variable is that we have an estimate divided by its standard error, and that kind of like gives us how far from zero the estimate is or the residual is on a standardized metric.
Yes.
Yeah.
But how do you compare this? Because the distance can be 0 and 5.
Yeah. Then we
4 and 3. For example, if you take the number equal 25.
Yeah.
But then one between 0 and 1 and 5 on the other line.
We standardize the estimates divide by the standard error or estimated standard deviation. So we are asking how far from zero we are on a standardized metric. So we have estimate divided by standard deviation or standard error, and that gives us the z statistic, and we can compare against the normal distribution. If this tells us how many standard deviations the estimate is from zero, can we rule out the zero as an impossible?
But there the assumption is that the value has a normal
distribution.
Yeah, the estimate mean 0 and variance 1, and then we are checking if the observed variable could have been by chance.
Yeah, so that's the idea of testing one coefficient.
What's the null hypothesis here?
Here the null hypothesis is that both are 0.
And how, okay.
And so what we do when we have a null hypothesis that both this one and that one are 0, so we compare how far the red point is from the origin, we use the chi-square distribution, and we basically minimize the sum of squared residuals again. So we take the sum of squared estimates divided by sum of squared standard deviations. So we standardize both axes here, and we take squares and we sum, and that gives us the chi-square statistic. So that's how it's basically calculated. So we look at how far from the origin we are, origin of null hypothesis, we are on a standardized metric. So that's the idea of null hypothesis significance test, or model fit.
Yeah, because sum of normal distributions add up to a chi-square distribution.
Yeah, sum of squared normal distribution adds up to it. It's defined as the chi-square is the sum of normal distributions. Sum of squared normal distributions.
So the previous example was just a simple example. What we generally do is not normal distribution.
So this is normally.
But
This is normally distributed in
because
large
everyone samples. Else is every other value is zero.
Yeah, because all these are zero because of how the estimation works. So these are actually constrained sample values because they are also, and this is the only thing that could be different. Okay, so that's about estimation. Then let's look at at models. There is a published model, and well, let's have a graphic break now. So we've been going forever.